This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by the Star Trek Starships Collection from Eagle Moss, the ultimate collection officially authorized by CBS Studios, featuring vessels from 50 years of Star Trek. Each is expertly sculpted, hand-painted, and comes with an authoritative collector's magazine. Start your collection today with the USS Enterprise 1701D for only $4.95 with free shipping. For details and to order, visit st-starships.com/readyroom. And by audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. If you love podcasts, you're going to love audible.com and the ability to read your favorite books, plus those you've been wanting to get to, while on the go or at work. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more details.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 207, Big Ball of Progress. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Matthew Rushing. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the kickoff of the 50th anniversary Star Trek art exhibition, 50 Artists, 50 Years, and the end of IDW's ongoing comic series, plus the launch of a new one called Boldly Go. Then in the feature, I hide in the holodeck while Matthew is joined by John Mills and Bruce Gibson to discuss Star Trek Beyond. So let's step into the Ready Room. Matthew, what's going on there? There's something on your shoulder. It looks like a Trekachu. Have you been playing Pokemon Go?
Oh, Chris, I knew you were going to bring this up. No, I have not been playing Pokemon Go, but I guess my wife thought it was funny to pay the $10 to have the Pokemon follow me around. So everybody keeps swarming around me to try and catch their Pokemon. So,
well, today I was washing dishes in the kitchen, and from outside, I heard someone say, "Don't go in there, that's someone's house." And a kid said, "But I found a Pokemon there."
Well, I mean, hey, all I know is it's so crazy. People are playing it at Arlington National Cemetery. They're having to try and ask them not to do that.
Yeah, it's crazy.
People have been playing it like a Holocaust museum. I mean, come on, people. It's just a game.
Well, we saw it on Star Trek, as Will Wheaton tweeted out. He warned us all years ago about this.
It's so true. My wife and I are driving home from their second viewing of Star Trek Beyond tonight, and we see some kids on the street, both with their phone, and my wife's like, "You get that Pokemon!"
That's awesome. All right. Well, today this is a somewhat unusual Ready Room in that Matthew here will be running the feature, because today's show, the feature discussion is about Star Trek Beyond, which I cannot see because I am not yet beyond October, which is where I have to be in order to watch the movie here in Japan in the theater. So Matthew,
isn't it just on like Apple TV at that point?
I will probably be able to not only buy the Blu-ray from the U.S., but receive the Blu-ray at least 1 month before it opens here in Japan.
Oh, yes, wow, that's crazy.
So anyway, Matthew is going to be running the feature today. So we're going to do a couple of news stories together, and then I will join Matthew again in the closing. The feature today will not involve me. So Matthew, let's go ahead and jump into news. And the first story I want to talk about is not related to Star Trek Beyond. I thought we needed a little something that doesn't tie into the movie, and that is the 50th anniversary art exhibition
called 50 Artists, 50 Years, which just opened at San Diego Comic-Con at the Michael J. Wolff Fine Arts Gallery in the historic Gaslamp Quarter. After the con, it's going to go on a global tour, but those who were at San Diego Comic-Con, which will be over by the time this episode drops, were able to see a lot of these amazing images. Matthew, you can see some of them in an article on StarTrek.com. What do you think about the concept of having artists create original artwork based on Star Trek?
Well, Chris, I just have to say, I honestly think this is a fantastic idea. If you've ever, you know, just searched Star Trek art on Google or something like there's that site DeviantArt.
Yeah.
You can see these incredible creations that people come up with. And I mean, we have some amazing artists that are going to be involved in this, like Paul Shipper, who does incredible work. He had a really great Star Trek Into Darkness poster that he did that I loved. Actually, I liked it way better than anything they created for the film that, you know, Paramount had come up with. J.K. Woodward, so much he's done. I mean, just these people are so talented, and seeing how they interpret Star Trek over, you know, the 50-year span, I think is just a fantastic idea. And really, I think it gives fans a way to truly celebrate the creativity of something that's been around for so long. And seeing how other people view it, getting to kind of look through their eyes and their art, what a wonderful experience for 50 years of Star Trek.
Yeah, these things are really cool. I, of course, cannot see the Star Trek one right now, but I did attend twice last year Star Wars Visions, which was sort of a similar thing that George Lucas did. He commissioned artists from around the world to create original artwork based on Star Wars. And in addition to the paintings, they also had original props and costumes and such from the films, as well as replicas. And it was really interesting. But what's really fascinating is to see how an artist can take material from the franchise they love and apply their craft to it to create something really unique that you might not have thought of before. And if you look at the artwork that you can see on StarTrek.com in this article called 50th Anniversary Art Exhibition Opens, you can see how unique some of these takes are. And they talked to a number of the artists in this article, and that includes, of course, you already mentioned Paul Shipper a moment ago, Matthew. His poster is interesting to me, and when I look at it, I was thinking of you because it's called Star Trek Inception, The Cage. It reminds me of a Star Wars poster.
Yeah, Paul Shipper really has modeled his artwork after the great Drew Struzan, mm-hmm. who did so many posters that we know. I think some of the most famous are Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Or, of course, the Star Wars posters. And so he really captured that kind of feel. And the posters that he does really bring that to life in new and different ways. And so, yeah, this Cage poster is just beautiful and incredible. I really think that he's done a magnificent job of capturing the alienness and the craziness of this, the first pilot from Star Trek. And what a great way, I mean, obviously, to celebrate Star Trek in 50 years, because, you know, even though nobody saw this pilot first, we all think of it now. I mean, especially people who may just queue it up on Netflix, they may watch The Cage first. So yeah. just a really great piece of art. But you're right. I mean, there are so many incredible pieces of art here in this that I love. And I would love to have a copy of, but I'm thinking I might have to get another job for this.
You might also need some more wall space, Matthew, because you've got quite a lot of stuff there in your little studio.
I do, Chris. I do. Actually, I'm running out of wall space, and I just procured the Star Trek Beyond poster. And so I'm trying to figure out where it's going to go and if it's going to replace another poster. So I don't know. Star Wars, watch out. You might get replaced.
You might have to tell your wife that this poster is going to go beyond the room into the hallway or somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, I don't know, we could just put it right over the bed.
I'm sure she's going to love that, Matthew.
Oh, totally, yeah.
She's going to be like, I can't sleep. Jayla's watching me all the time. What's going on?
I don't know,
on?
It's got Chris Pine on it, so she might be okay with it.
All right. So this exhibition, after it leaves San Diego Comic-Con, it's going to tour globally, they say. We only know of two cities outside of the U.S. so far, and we only know the schedule through October. I don't know what comes after that, but for those who want to see this, it's going to be at Star Trek Las Vegas in the Rio Suites Hotel from August 3rd to August 7th, so that's a wonderful opportunity for so many of you listening to see it. After that, August 19th to September 5th, it will be at the Canadian National Exhibition in Toronto. September 16th through September 25th, it will be at the Paley Center for Media in New York City. And October 7th to October 9th, it's a very short stop, it's going to be at Destination Star Trek Europe in Birmingham in the UK. And we'll find out later where it goes from there. I don't know if it will make its way over to Tokyo. We have so many wonderful art museums in Tokyo, in the area where I work, that would be perfect for this, like the Mori Art Museum, which is where the Star Trek Visions exhibition took place. So hopefully it will get over here and I'll get to see it at some point, but I'm not holding my breath because Star Trek's not a big thing over here, but we'll see.
Well, you know, Chris, it's not coming here either. So I'm still trying to find my way up to Seattle to check out the EMP Museum. They have a huge Star Trek exhibit there that actually even costs extra. So I'd really like to go see that. They're celebrating the 50th anniversary. So, you know, things like this, it's, if they're in your area, go see them, because, you know, they're not going to be there forever. And, you know, who knows when they'll do this again. So really live up the 50th anniversary.
Definitely. And if you want to know more about this event, I talked about this back on Hyper Channel 152, which is called Pictures at an Exhibition. I think it was on April 1st. It was back in April. And I'm pretty sure at the time I talked a bit more about some of the different artists and the different pieces that are going to be there. So check out Hyper Channel 152 for a bit more information there.
April 1st, is that the longest running April 1st joke, like April Fool's joke for people? They get there and you're like, aha, not really it.
Could be. So Matthew, let's talk about one other story that I picked, especially because you were on the show today, because of course you are the co-host of Literary Treks, our books and comics show here on the network. When you and I hosted that show together, we used to go through every issue of the Star Trek ongoing comic when it came out, and we would talk about those. And in August, the final issue of that series will come out. And then in October, it will be replaced by a new series called Boldly Go, which has a very different art style. It's still set in the Abramsverse or Kelvin timeline. And as I understand it, it will pick up the pieces from Star Trek Beyond. So what are your thoughts on this transition ending ongoing and giving us a new Abramsverse series?
Well, Chris, it is really interesting. Just a few weeks ago, Dan and Bruce and I were on Literary Treks talking about the fact that we had heard that they were going to be ending the ongoing series at issue 60, and they had not made this announcement yet. And so we were kind of scratching our heads. Really? There's the new movie coming out. You know, the series has actually been very good recently. They've had some amazing comics and arcs go on. And so we hoped that they would have something. And in fact, as this recording, Chris, our Literary Treks 156, we were talking about the penultimate issue of this, number 59. So yeah, ongoing, leaving, and so excited that, yes, it is going to be continuing. It's going to be ongoing, but it's going to be boldly going this time.
Exactly.
And boldly go. And to me, I like the art. I think it's beautiful. I'm very excited that they're going to continue this. Part of that, too, my excitement comes from, Chris, is that, one, interesting things happen in Star Trek Beyond, and I can't wait to see where they put the crew next. Also, we know they're going to be doing a fourth film. And so because of all of this, I think, you know, the comic has been a really fun way of continuing to get to know the characters between the films and feel more and more comfortable with them. And so I'm really excited to have us be able to continue to do that. And, you know, heck, this run is going to have as many films as The Next Generation soon, and could have a fifth if it, you know, they keep doing well. So the more power to them, I say, because, you know, I've enjoyed it, and I'm just excited that we'll be getting more of the comic, because recently, goodness, they have had some incredible issues. The Legacy of Spock series that they did was beyond brilliant. So if you haven't checked that out, it was a 4-issue arc, totally worth picking. I mean, you don't have to have read really any of the other ongoing comics, really. It's just a fantastic story. So yeah, I'm really glad that this is going to continue going on.
It's very cool. You know, the art style, it's not an exact analogy here, but it reminds me a little bit of when Nintendo transitioned Zelda to this very cartoonish style.
Mm-hmm.
This is not as cartoonish as what they did with Zelda, but they went from a more kind of realistic look into this cartoonish look for a while, and then they transitioned back. But it's going to be interesting to see stories told in this art style. It looks pretty cool. I love Uhura's hair in this image that's being shown on the Trek Collective, which is where we're finding an article that we're referring to. It's actually a cover art for maybe for the first issue.
Yeah, it's very dramatic, the art. And as you said, it also has slightly more of an animated feel to it. But I think it just really works. And to me, I enjoy really good comic art that does take some creative liberty, but you can also recognize the characters still.
Not like some of those comics that you and I have done from the past, especially with the Next Generation ones.
Is that Riker or Data or
it's like,
I can't even tell.
It was worse than that. Some of them are like, is that Riker or Ensign Ro? I'm not sure.
Yeah. Oh, wait. Ro doesn't have the beard.
Sometimes it was very hard to tell who the characters were.
Yes, it was.
But so in this case, it's very obvious who they are, so it's good.
Yeah, so I'm excited. The Boldly Go series is going to kick off in October, so that's wonderful. And we'll only have a month off between when the final issue of Ongoing comes out in August. And as we mentioned, this does pick up after Star Trek Beyond. And if you have seen the movie, you do know that we're continuing on. And I can't wait to see where we go from there. And they've got some great new assets to be able to play with. It also makes me wonder a lot of things. So I'm just going to stop talking before I start giving things away about the movie.
Very good. You know, they missed a really big opportunity here to name this series Beyond Beyond or Beyond Squared, right?
I actually asked that math question on Literary Checks the other day. I said, what is Beyond Beyond? Is that like beyond infinity where it doesn't really exist, or what is that?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Beyond Squared would be a good name for
Beyond Squared,
a comic,
yes.
Though. Yeah.
All right. Very good. Well, thanks for sharing your thoughts on the comic transition. That's all the news we have today. Before we head into the feature, we would like to thank our sponsor for today's show, Eagle Moss, and the official Star Trek Starships collection. As you know, as a Star Trek fan and as a listener of The Ready Room, Eagle Moss makes these amazing starship models that are so detailed, and they have so much love and attention given to them during the process.
Pew, 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 pew. Oh, Chris, I'm sorry. I was playing with my Eagle Moss ships here. I got the Defiant and the NX-01 refit, and they were battling. So, I mean, those are some of the fun things you could do if you get these ships.
You could. You could put them on display, or you could have space battles like Matthew is right now. Matthew, let me ask you quickly, because you have the NX-01 refit right there in your hand. This is one I haven't been able to see in person myself. What do you think about the job they did with Doug Drexler's design that we never got to see on the show, but is rumored to have been in the works for a fifth season and beyond?
Well, Chris, it really is a wonderful job that they did. The model, like all of their models, is well crafted. The paint job on it is fantastic, and it really does. I mean, it feels like the most accurate representation of this that you've seen. It's like it flew straight out of one of Doug's drawings that he did, that you've seen online.
The main place we've seen this is in the, well, online, of course, but also in the Ships of the Line calendar, I believe they had a painting of this, right?
Yeah. As well as the Rise of the Federation
books. Oh, that's right. Yes.
The Endeavor, which is T'Pol's ship in that series, is also a refit NX class. So yeah, I mean, this model has only been seen a few places, but it really does. I mean, the model is so good, it feels like it just flew off the page and came into 3D, and you didn't even need 3D glasses.
That's good. So when they make these models, they use the actual CG models that are used in production, and when possible, they use photos of the original studio models. And of course, in the case of this one, they had to use other reference materials because we didn't see it on screen in an episode. And it just goes to show how they're able to use those materials to create really authentic representation of the ships. Each model is cast in a specially formulated metallic resin and hand-painted. The hand painting is amazing. The details are really incredible. Each ship also comes with a display base, which is designed specifically for that ship. So it's made to really fit properly to hold up the ship because, you know, the weight distribution is different depending on which ship it is. And so they really take the time to make unique bases. They're not all just standard bases. And also there is a collector's magazine, which features behind the scenes info, original design sketches, and a breakdown of the technology on board the ship. As a Ready Room listener, you can start your collection today with the Enterprise 1701D for just $4.95 with free shipping, and new models ship twice monthly and are delivered directly to your door. You can cancel your subscription at any time, but I know once you see these, you're not going to want to do that, because they're just really wonderful. I have many of them myself. I don't have the NX-01 refit, unfortunately, but I do have the Defiant, and I have many others scattered around me right now as I'm recording this show. So go to st-starships.com/readyroom to find out more, view pictures of the entire collection, and sign up. Get that 1701D for just $4.95 with free shipping, and get two ships every month and build up your collection. You'll be supporting the Ready Room and Trek FM in general at the same time. It's a wonderful opportunity at st-starships.com/readyroom. And we really thank Eagle Moss so much for their support of the show and the network.
And before you know it, Chris, you can be the admiral of your own fleet.
That would be nice. All right. So, Matthew, I am going to turn everything over to you now to head into the feature to discuss Star Trek Beyond. There are going to be spoilers in here, I'm pretty sure. Right, Matthew?
Yeah, we are going to spoil the movie. So if you haven't seen it, I would say maybe skip the feature, go see the movie, and then come back. If you haven't seen the movie, I kind of want to ask why you haven't seen the movie yet, because it's so good.
Because by the time this drops, it'll be almost a week, right, since it opened. So.
Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, we want to be able to talk through the movie for you and basically with you. And so definitely make sure that you have seen the film.
All right. So, Matthew, the captain's chair is yours, and I'll see you on the other side.
He likes that seat. Star Trek fans get the thrill of seeing a new movie in theaters, and this 50th anniversary of Star Trek, fans held their collective breath as Star Trek Beyond was finally released. And I am joined by Bruce Gibson and John Mills here in the Ready Room to talk about it. Guys, man, this place is palatial compared to the 602 Club. What's going on?
I don't know, but I will say, don't let Ruby know, it's a little cleaner in here than I'm used to. I could get accustomed to this. Just saying.
Yeah, same here, because I've been looking around and I haven't found any food on the floor. They actually sweep this place, unlike the 602 Club.
I was a little thrown off when we weren't stepping on, you know, peanut shells and other sticky things on the floor. I'm so glad to be in this wonderful captain seat tonight. And man, it feels good. So, guys, we're here to talk about Star Trek, not Star Wars. I think this may be the first time that we get to let our Trek flag fly together.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, this is exciting. I'm very excited about that. Yeah, I don't even know if John likes Star Trek.
There are rumors indicating that I could go either way on this. I don't know.
Well, tonight, hopefully we will find out which side of the fence that John is on, what team he's batting for, Team Star Trek or Team Not Star Trek. But we have a brand new Star Trek film to talk about, Star Trek Beyond. And so I wanted to ask you guys, though, before we get into to talking about the new film, where were you guys going into this? Because I know where I was, but I'm kind of wondering where your headspace was at when they announced Star Trek Beyond, who was going to be the director. Where were you coming into this? What about you, Bruce?
I remember being a little concerned because Robert Orci was writing, and then they I wasn't concerned about him writing, but then they said he was directing and he never directed a movie before. And I had concern about that because he would be a first-time director. And really, we're going to have a first-time director do the 50th anniversary movie for Star Trek? A little worried about that. And then when he was moved off of this project and they started bringing other people in and Justin Lin in, I was starting to feel a little bit better about things. But I was a little cautious, but I have full confidence in Bad Robot and J.J. Abrams, and I really felt that I was staying positive. I really felt that this might be something good.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I was coming into it very positive. As anybody who listened to Commentary Trek Stars would know, I became sort of an overnight Justin Lin fan as we looked at his filmography, and I remain so because I think he's one of the more talented directors out there right now. But I was hopeful. They had kind of scotched it with Into Darkness, and so I think I was cautiously optimistic that they recognized some shortcomings and were going to address them. But at the same time, it was weird because I think that this summer movie season has sort of burned me out in terms of excitement. So the release time for this was unfortunate. Because I've really sort of run out of energy to be excited about movies at this point because, you know, the season keeps starting earlier and earlier. And so I didn't see enough marketing materials that got me like jazzed. But I think part of that is just, you know, where I was in general. So I was just cautiously optimistic and, you know, really just wanted it to be a good movie without, you know, any gimmicks or anything. Just be good.
I'm right there with you guys in the sense that, you know, I came into this as positively as possible. You know, I was on the last Ready Room where we talked about Into Darkness. I still like Into Darkness. There are issues with it, but, you know, I was excited to see this film franchise continue. I like the characters. I like most of the actors they have playing them. I think that they have done a good job in creating an interesting idea of being able to do these characters in a new, fresh way, hopefully, that we haven't seen before or give us new insights. And so all of that I'm bringing into it. But I also am right there with you, John, where I didn't see a lot of marketing for this film. And I was a little bit trepidatious about that because I was worried that people would forget, like you said, it's a big movie year and it's been starting earlier and earlier and we've had amazing epics this year already and huge tentpole films. And by the time you get to the dog days of July, I was worried people would forget it. And without seeing a bunch of the marketing, I was a little bit worried. Now, I do have to say, I did only see two trailers for this film and that then became on purpose because I didn't want to go into this movie knowing a lot. I just wanted to go in and be surprised by hopefully a good Star Trek adventure. And so for me, when I walked into the theater, I've seen trailer one, I've seen trailer two, that's it. I didn't see, you know, TV ads. I tried to stay away from all that stuff. I just wanted to go in and hopefully be inspired by what Star Trek had to say in its 50th anniversary.
And here's where I differ, because I saw trailer one, two, three, four, five. I watched everything. I read everything. I went into this movie pretty much knowing the whole storyline. So there wasn't anything in here that was a huge surprise to me in terms of story. I kind of put it all together early on going in, and I know I'm spoiling the movie for myself by doing that, but I couldn't contain myself, and I kind of like knowing things going in because it makes it easier for me to follow and maybe look for certain things in the movie as opposed to being surprised and taken off guard going in the first time. But you mentioned about trailers. Did you even see the trailer they released with The Force Awakens where they had the Beastie Boys music playing in it? There was a lot of negative reaction to that.
Yeah, see, I saw that trailer, and I liked it. I remember, in fact, John Mills, we were talking back and forth about it on iMessage, and we were both like, well, I liked it. Well, I liked it, and everybody else was like, I hate it.
Well, I think that the reaction to the Beastie Boys trailer was, you know, the Kelvin timeline has been fractious for fans, and having that song thrown at them in the very first trailer, I think that any ill will that was residual for some, you know, some fans out there, some very vocal fans that weren't, you know, plugged into the Kelvin timeline, it was almost like throwing it in their face to say, ha, we're still using it, even though, the use of Sabotage in Star Trek 09 was greeted with less than enthusiastic reception by many people. You know, although I did suddenly want to have, you know, a Budweiser while calling somebody on my Nokia phone.
I know, me too. I mean, watching the film, I was like, Kirk drinks Budweiser. I need to drink more Budweiser.
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, I think that Beastie Boys was a declaration that they were still embracing the new mentality behind the movie. And I think that's probably why that first trailer didn't fly for a lot of people.
Well, and I mean, come on. This is the universe where ships do barrel rolls. Just because of the camera movement. I mean, you know, you flip the whole ship upside down because of the way you're moving the camera. I mean, this is more of a rock and roll kind of Star Trek.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, especially 09, it had the spirit of Star Trek, and you felt like it could continue into being more Star Trek. So as we get to this film, just at where we are going to spoil it, so if you haven't seen it, please stop listening now. But a quick synopsis is this. The Enterprise is in the third year of its 5-year mission, and Kirk finds himself a little bit lost as to his place. And they get to the edge of Federation space, which sits deep space. Now, I mean the Yorktown, the snow globe
deep
in space.
Deep space Yorktown.
Deep space Yorktown. And they are met there by an alien coming out of a nebula, a very dense nebula that says they need their help. They go to help that alien get her crew back. Craziness ensues, and Kirk and the crew end up saving the galaxy as we know it once again. That's a pretty quick synopsis. So I wanted to ask you guys just initial thoughts. Okay, that's where you were when you went into the movie. That was your headspace. Coming out of the movie, what was your initial reaction?
Well, my initial reaction was, wow. I mean, honestly, it caught me a little off guard exactly how well. I mean, I had read the interviews where Justin Lin said, you know, I grew up watching the original series. And declaring his love for the series over and over. And this was the first Star Trek film in a very long time where I felt like somebody that loved the source material as much as I did made the movie. And I was happy because I felt like I had watched just an extended TOS style plot. It had the feel and the verve I was very happy coming out of the movie. I really was. Happy is how I felt.
I feel like we should play that happy song, but because I was happy too coming out of the movie. It when I saw Into Darkness, and by the way, I like both. I like Star Trek 09. I like Star Trek Into Darkness. But when it came out of Into Darkness, I was happy, but there was just something not quite right. There was just a little bit of it that I was unsettled about, because I remember I was traveling out of town and I called my wife and I said, I really liked it, but there's just something about it that just doesn't sit right with me. I can't put my finger on it. This time I came out of the movie and I didn't have that type of feeling. It was just, it all felt right. It felt like a really good movie. It felt fun. I felt happy, as John did. I was very happy about it. And I really loved the Yorktown Space Station. That was one thing that really stood out to me, because it was someplace different that we hadn't seen quite like that in Star Trek. And they actually gave us some nice establishing shots and shows around the station. And I really enjoyed it giving some breathing room to an environment for us to get familiar with before we got into the action. So I really enjoyed that. And I also enjoyed the planet looking alien, you know, looking a little different too. So those were the things I was thinking as I left the theater.
The thing that I was struck by was how almost immediately in the film I was laughing. That whole beginning scene with Kirk, where he's with the aliens and you can tell he's trying to be on his best behavior as these aliens continue to just kind of claw their way under his skin. He's trying to broker this peace treaty. They're just being belligerent. And the moment he gets back to the Enterprise and he's like, ugh, I ripped my shirt again.
Yeah.
That's the moment I'm right where you are, John. This is made by people who know Star Trek, love Star Trek, and wanted to bring back the fun homages to the original series without slapping you in the face over it. You know, like, it doesn't have to be Khan. It's just the little things, you know, talking about a green hand in space, mentioning Romulan Wars and Zindi Wars, things like that, where it's like these people know what they're talking about. And even if you don't know what they're talking about, this movie's fun. It has some stuff to say. And it's a great space adventure. So it's servicing, I think, just in the end, everyone. And when I came out of the film, I was just so relieved. I think, oh, it was good, you know, like, because, you know, they've already announced that they're going to do a fourth one. So I felt like, okay, this one has to be something that where people will be clamoring for more. And I got that feeling like I wanted more. I want to see more, because I feel like after three films, you know, these characters are all kind of set now as where the original series characters kind of became their own in the movie, the franchise, the films really built those characters. I feel like they're all finally in that space in the Kelvin timeline now. So, yeah, so much about this movie had me excited in that way.
You know, I will say too that it's interesting you use the word relieved. I think that relief is sort of a component to my reaction as well, because this, when I went into Darkness, granted we all were already speculating about the plot and obviously it wasn't going to, but when they said they were going to make a sequel to 09, I'm happier with this as the sequel to 09. This movie very much treated Into Darkness as optional as to whether you want to embrace it as still existing. And I enjoyed them giving me that mental out. And I guess that's where my relief comes from, where much like, you know, Star Trek VI, if you want to go along and say Star Trek V was still there, cool. And if not, there's absolutely nothing to contradict that. You can ignore the middle child, as it were, of this trilogy.
This is the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, and we were getting a movie, and the thing I feared the most was this could be a dud. And what an awful way to be in the 50th anniversary of this franchise and have a movie that people don't like. So that was the thing I was most worried about. Sure, you've got your good Star Trek movies, you've got your bad Star Trek movies, and you're always going to have some good and bad. That's going to happen. They're not always going to be great. But to go into the 50th and have a bad movie just was something I was worried about. So I was very relieved that we have a movie that most people seem to enjoy, and especially Star Trek fans enjoy. And I'm sure not every Star Trek fan loves this movie, and not every Star Trek fan likes the JJ verse or the Kelvin timeline, but thankfully the majority of people seem to really enjoy this movie, Trek fans and non-Trek fans. And I love talking to people who are not big Star Trek fans and hear them gush about this movie. It makes my day.
My wife is not a Star Trek fan, decidedly not a Star Trek fan. I cannot get her to watch Star Trek for love or money. Like, she watched 09 and she liked it, but she's never gone back. Like, I wasn't able to use that as a wedge to, like, get her to go into further viewing. But to speak to your point, Bruce, I think that this is the type of Star Trek movie where I could present it to her, and I honestly believe that she would have, you know, she would watch this, and then I could say, and there's more like this that I could show to you, and, you know, let's just try that. Like, this is a good movie to sell Star Trek to somebody, in my opinion.
Oh, I completely agree with that. I mean, to me, honestly, the only thing that could make this better is to see more of the original series aliens that we know. Like, what's it going to take for an Andorian to be having a fight scene on Yorktown?
I've been attacked by an Andorian.
I mean, just an Andorian, even just in the background. That's all I want. I just want to see a freaking Andorian or a Tellarite or something. You know, we make all these incredible new aliens, but it's like, I want to see their versions of the original series aliens, because, I you know, just think of what they can do. I mean, Enterprise did a great job with bringing those aliens to life. Just think of what a movie budget could do bringing those aliens to life. So, I mean, to me, that's the only thing that I'm, like, still kind of wanting and missing as a Star Trek fan. I'm like, oh, can we just grab a little bit more of that TOS and bring it into this? Because they do it in the comics with the ongoing series and stuff, and they haven't done it yet in the films. And, you know, I mean, we've seen Vulcans and Romulans, but that's kind of it for, you know, our TOS aliens, Orions. I think those are the three.
Yeah, but and it's funny you're saying that, because It's almost like what's been said about Star Wars The Force Awakens, about Maz Kanata's castle, and it shows all these aliens, but they're not familiar aliens. It's the same criticism. It's as if movie studios are trying to brand their own aliens and not borrow from past movies and series. But yeah, I'm with you. I hadn't really thought that much about it, but I would have liked to have seen more familiar aliens, even just on the bridge of the Enterprise.
Well, and I mean, you had the Yorktown base, too. I mean, you could have just thrown some in the background as, you know, I mean, we do see, again, we see an Andorian that Chekhov apparently didn't go so well in the bedroom for him, and so he gets kicked out. But that's, you know, we really don't see any other familiar aliens on that space station, and that thing is, like, ginormous. I mean, it makes Deep Space Nine look like a child's toy.
Yeah, I mean... See, the thing is, I can go either way on it. I mean, stuff like that would be nice in a 50th anniversary movie, I agree, to have them at least in the background of the Yorktown, because, you know, there is a certain amount of fan service that should be expected in a 50th anniversary movie. I mean, you know,
like Skyfall with James Bond, where you got a lot of that stuff, and it's a wink and a nod to all the fans who have been around.
But at the same time, you know, I do get and support the urge for them to do something different, because, you know, if I see all of this, you know, these different original aliens on the screen, at the very least, I feel like the director, the writer, you know, everybody came into it saying, we're going to put our own stamp on this. And that I want a director to have that sense of ownership about the script. I think that when you get into the territory of, are we going to have an Andorian here? Are we going to have a Klingon there? You can weight yourself down with the moment of reveal or lingering on them in a background shot. You know, I'll call out specifically Into Darkness with that, where that Klingon scene was, the way it was constructed was a lot of fan service. You know, it didn't flow naturally because they lingered. And were so determined about making sure that, you know, it sort of like got through to you, hey, it's Klingons. But, you know, so I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm just, you know, hedging either way. But for me, that's such a minor consideration.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not saying that to be like, to be reductive or dismissive of anybody saying that they want, like, I get it. But, you know, for me, I'm in that headspace where I have to think about it to say, oh, wait, right, I didn't see an Andor, you know, or a Tellarite. It's all right by me.
It's not a huge knock for me against the film. Sure. It's just something that I would love to see, especially if they are going to continue this Kelvin timeline. I would like to see some of that stuff kind of trickle its way in, even if it's just the background. But again, it's not like it destroys the movie for me because I didn't get my fan service in that way. No, that's just like a small minor thing. I was thinking like, oh, 50th anniversary would be kind of cool to see some of these things, even if it was just in the background, that, you know, we'd pick out as we freeze frame certain things, you know, like, oh, look at that.
Right. Yeah. You know, but speaking of returning to things, how would you guys feel about bringing the Yorktown back for the next movie, having it continue to be sort of a launching hub for another adventure, have them start off there or go there at the end of the movie, like keep it in that spirit of, instead of Earth becoming their touchstone, the Yorktown becomes their touchstone through future movies.
I mean, I love the Yorktown, so I would welcome to see it at any time. But at the same time, I really would like them to be as inventive and bring something new to the next movie. And maybe there's another base that's totally different. I'd like to see something new and different each time. I don't want to keep going back to the same things. I mean, we're obviously going to have a new ship in the next movie, too. So, but...
Well, no,
We'll talk about that later,
yeah,
guys.
Okay, okay.
Later.
No, I actually like your idea though, John. Obviously the ship that they're going to have next is being built at Yorktown. And so I think that's a great place if you want to launch from there. I think that's a great idea just to give us a look, or, you know, it's always something, you know, if they do 5 or 6 or however many movies they may get. I mean, all these characters and these actors are young, so, you know, as long as they continue to make money and do well and make good stories, they'll keep us coming back. So I think it's always a great idea to have that in the background to maybe be able to come back to, because it's a great design, and I really like the way that it fit into the film. So I really want to get into, because I think this movie has some incredible character growth for the different characters, especially our main three and then a couple of the others. And really, the film starts with Kirk in a place that we've never seen Kirk, because in the original series films, we see Kirk already as an admiral trying to get the Enterprise back, but we never see what would cause somebody whose first best destiny is to be a starship captain to think he wants to ride the Pine. You know what I'm saying? Like, he wants to sit on the bench.
Well, wait a minute. His name is Chris Pine. That's why.
Exactly. Exactly. That was the pun. You caught it. But I mean, it's the fact that the movie starts with Kirk saying, and it's, you know, it's hard to feel grounded when even gravity is artificial. And he's questioning, what are we doing out here? If like, this is just never-ending space. Are we just in a pointless mission? Like, he's questioning his purpose, who he is, but not as the 20-year-old, you know, that we got in the original film, who's just cocky, you know, bastard. But the man who's been somewhere, done some things, and is kind of having almost that midlife crisis of like, what am I doing? I thought, what a great way and what a great place to bring this character, because we've never seen Kirk go through that before.
You know, I think we've seen Kirk go through it, but older, and like you said, in a different admiral context of questioning, you know, what am I doing with my life? And, you know, am I really doing what I want? I think that the interesting thing about this is that there is sort of a meta treatment of Kirk's struggle, in the sense that the Kirk we're familiar with has this, this crisis of identity after he makes the bad decision. And in this timeline, this Kirk is a little bit closer in age to, you know, to us, where he is going through things that I think that anybody, you know, from their like mid-30s forward, you know, starts to feel of like, well, oh yeah, well, I mean, I like my job, but I'm doing this every day. You know, like, I love the line, you know, it started to feel episodic. You know, there yeah. is that very much toil and drudgery, and this sense of that I think is very relatable to waking up one day and realizing that, you know, you took your job because, you know, hey, I'm lucky enough, I found something I was good at and I like. And then you wake up one morning and you're like, well, I know what time I'm going to get my coffee. I know what time I'm going to go for a walk. I know what time I'm going to get, you know, and you start to feel that pressure of routine without it being crushing. And what I do like is that this version of Kirk has enough maturity to recognize when he is making an emotional decision. Well, I mean, you know, somebody, of course, checks him on it and tells him to consider and everything, but he has the emotional maturity to recognize when he's having that crisis and add appropriate intellectual weight to his decision-making process to balance out the emotional.
That was one thing I was really hoping for this movie, is to see a more mature Kirk. That we're seeing growth in the character from the previous two movies. So that was a big win for me. And that's exactly what we all go through in our maturity. And even when we get our dream jobs or situations that we're in, is where we wanted to be. But then it's the question of, is there something else? Is there something more? Or maybe this didn't quite live up to what you think or thought it was going to be like. And I feel like that's, you know, what Kirk was trying to come to grips with, is just, am I in the right place? Should I be going forward? So should I be doing something different? Should I be doing something more? And, you know, he learns, I think, you know, we see later in the movie that he belongs with family, and he lost a big piece of his family, which has always haunted him his whole life and his whole career. But he's always had the biggest support he could ever want with that crew he's been spending 3 years out in space with. And even though his ship has died, everything about that crew continues to live on. It's not about the ship, it's about the people.
It was an interesting thing. I was talking to my wife as we were driving home from our second viewing of the film, and I said, you know what's really interesting about this Kirk is that he's my age. Because Chris Pine is a little bit younger than I am in real life. And I'm thinking, the like you were saying, those are definitely the struggles that we kind of go through at that age of like, is this really it? And not only that, but I love the way that they layered on top of that, so that Kirk and Spock are mirroring each other. They're both kind of going through the same thing. You know, McCoy tells Kirk, he says, you spent all this time trying to be George Kirk, and now you're just wondering what it means to be Jim. And both Kirk and Spock are struggling with, how do you find your identity when your identity has been built in trying to live up to somebody else? You know, whether it's your father or your mentor, like Ambassador Spock. And I love the fact that these characters are going through the same thing. They're too scared to talk to each other about it. And yeah. I really liked that growth for Kirk in that side. But I also liked that they were doing that with Spock, because I felt like they used Leonard Nimoy's untimely death very purposefully in the film to help drive this Spock's growth and maturity towards, you know, he's a Spock that's a little bit different than we know. He's probably a little bit closer to his human side than he is the Vulcan side. But I like that. I like that there's a little bit of difference between him and the Spock that we knew for so many years with Leonard Nimoy.
Sure. You know, and while we've been talking about this in specific, I suddenly realized that I don't know whether it was intentional, I doubt it, but what the echo is for me is George Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life, where like the scene that comes to mind in specific is when his friend, who has done well for himself, drives by and George walks back to his car and, you know, and sort of kicks the door. And, you know, the whole thrust of that movie is, you know, you're doing what you were meant to do. You are living up to your potential, whether you realize it or not. And you can, you know, succeed here by embracing it. And I, you know, so like I could see that in Kirk as well, that echo.
I mean, that's why we go out into space. That's why we're looking for a new life and new civilizations, so that we can learn not just about other cultures and other races, but also to learn about ourselves. And that's what Kirk is doing in this journey with the rest of his crew, is they're out there exploring, but they're learning and they're growing about and questioning things about themselves. That's what that's all about. It's not just about finding new things out there and how they're different, but how we relate that to ourselves and what we can learn from it. And that's one of the big messages from this movie that I gathered from it. When it comes to Spock, I think I would have preferred to see him be the more logical, less emotional Spock that we had in the previous two films. But I feel like they've kept up that theme of his character from the previous films. But I was, in a lot of ways, I was hoping we'd get less emotional Spock and a little more of the stoic, emotionless Spock that we had in the original series.
Yeah, but you know what? And this is another thing that I think is really interesting, is we're sitting here, like in the previous two movies, I don't recall ever having a conversation this in depth about the character development. And I get what you're saying about Spock, but at the same time, I think it's so interesting. There's almost this juxtaposition where Kirk is the one that sort of swallows it and keeps going as best he can, and Spock is the one who falters with his emotions at certain points. I think that that was a really interesting juxtaposition, that the characters, you realize what a balance they are, that when they are out of sorts, Kirk is the more calm one for all intents and purposes, and Spock is the one more in touch with his human side. So it's sort of the two characters being off their game plays up what they complement about each other.
Well, and that was really nice, I think, because, and I just want to compliment real quickly. Pine is effortless as Kirk.
Agree.
I mean, the guy I think is perfect for Kirk. And if you were ever wondering if somebody else could inhabit the character of Kirk and make you believe, Chris Pine, everybody. I think the same thing for Carl Urban. Guy's McCoy, yeah, to me. I mean, he just is McCoy, and the presence that he brings to both of those characters, you know, I feel like McCoy is the glue that holds Kirk and Spock together, and he's the one who can kind of speak into their lives in the way nobody else can. And I really like what they give him to do in this film, because he gets to be kind of like, he's the counselor on the ship. There's no counselor here, but he's the one who's, yeah, kind of talking to Kirk, and he's also the one who's kind of talking to Spock and helping them find resolution to their, you know, kind of deep-seated emotional issues that they're going through. And he does it in a way that helps each character while still staying true to who McCoy has just always been. And I just, every movie, I just want more McCoy, and I'm glad we got more of him in this film. Less of the, you know, just the metaphors every 5 seconds,
yeah,
and more of an actual character that you can really grab onto and be like, man, I want to have a drink of Glenfiddich 30 with this guy.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that Urban does bring something vital, but I think that the real magic he brings is that you do believe. I mean, in a sense, you know, look at everything we had to go through with the character of McCoy in the old timeline before he finally had, you know, the moment in Star Trek III where he, you know, talks to the unconscious Spock I never told you how I felt about you sort of conversation. And we get that here in what I think is just one of the most fun, loving ways that you can do it with movie or television characters, where when they're alone, he's going to be nice to Spock, but he's very honest about the fact, basically, you know, but when we're with everybody else, I hope you know I'm still going to just treat you badly. You know, I'm never going to admit that this conversation happened, even though I love you like a brother. I love that. I thought that was, and I think Urban made that work.
Yeah, and they're just like brothers when he's telling Spock, when Spock is telling McCoy when they're on the planet and he's injured that he's been thinking about leaving Starfleet, and he's like, well, you know, Jim's not going to like that. You know, that Jim's going to be devastated, but for me, I'll throw a party. And, you know, Spock knows he's kidding around. They know they have that kind of relationship, just like brothers. Those are the kind of things brothers do with each other. They pick on each other. Heck, we pick on each other, too. We're not even brothers, but we're all becoming brothers, right?
Yeah. Yes, we are.
Yeah.
Yes, a band of brothers we are. I have to say what was great about this film, and I think this probably comes from Simon Pegg is really being the person who took on writing the movie for the most part, is giving the other characters something to do. And what I loved is that Scotty had more to do than just be the guy who fixes things. Like, he had a very integral role, and it was connected with the new character that we got with Jayla. And both of them and the way they worked together was so fun. But more importantly, the way that he connected with her and her position emotionally was really powerful, I thought, as well, because Kirk is not in a place to be all inspirational and somebody who wants to be all rah-rah about the team. But Scotty's in a place where he can do that. And when he kind of talks her into helping them, it's a really beautiful scene, and it just brings so much life and vigor to a character who's usually just comic relief. But I felt like they really, especially with the character Scotty, they gave him a lot of depth.
Yeah, I don't think it's any accident that Simon Pegg had a heavy hand in writing it, and Scotty suddenly was, you know, so heavily featured in the film. Which, and I've said on other forums that I would never hold him accountable to that, because if I ever wrote a movie, I'd probably be in every scene. You know, even if it was just like a picture of me in the background, it's like, don't forget about me. I think that is true of Scotty. I think that's true of all of the characters. It was really nice to see the characters working together in a great teamwork fashion. And there's even that tip of the hat, you know, sort of to the Star Trek IV hijinks when, you know, in this timeline, in this movie, Uhura and Sulu are the ones who sneak off to, like, go find out the secrets that they need to fix everything. Like, that's a nice nod, too, that, you know, that the crew is capable of functioning when they're separated the same way that they can, they can still figure out everything. Kirk is not necessary to them. Like, what makes them a great crew is Kirk, yes, is their leader, but they function very well together as subunits, and that's what makes everything move so clearly, and that was very obvious in this movie.
And Uhura was given more to do, too. Just to throw that out there, too. A lot of complaints of the last movie was all her character did was just, here, I'm going to go with the word pine. We used pine before. But she's pining for Spock that whole movie. This one, she separated herself from Spock even emotionally until the end. They get back together. But that allowed us to see a different side of Uhura and see her more active.
Well, and what was neat was watching the characters in pairings that, for the most part, I mean, Spock and McCoy is one that we've seen. But Kirk working with Chekhov specifically, I thought was really interesting, because I feel like that Kirk is that kind of mentor character to Chekhov, and to see them working together, it was fun and vibrant, and it also did a great job of just showing you how far the character of Chekhov has matured. And watching the film was very bittersweet for me, because I loved all they were giving him to do, and the thought that he won't be back is very heartbreaking. But what a great film to have him, you know, be able to leave us with, because he really does have some great moments. And I think the character of Chekhov was really served well in this movie. So really was thankful to see that. And it made, again, it just made for a great pairing of Kirk being a mentor to somebody when he's in the middle of kind of his midlife crisis. There's still some people that really look up to him and see him as kind of this, you know, kind of infallible type character. And
well, and I think that's what makes Lynn so specifically well suited to have been the one to direct this movie, is that, you know, if you look at the Fast and Furious movies, it's all about, you know, the big team is working toward a giant goal, but then everybody splits off into their subgroups. And he knows how, you know, he has always known how to make it so that, you know, everything functions well and the character pairings all make sense, you know, while at the same time working to the larger narrative. So I think that in and of itself, that structure of the movie lends itself to why Lynn was such a good pick for this one.
Question about our new character, Jayla. I wanted to ask y'all specifically about her and what you thought of her addition. And are you hoping to see her in subsequent films?
I would like to see her coming up. You know, I've heard people talk about, you know, of course, they're not going to replace Anton with another actor to play Chekhov. That's already been said. I know J.J. Abrams has mentioned that. So it would be cool to see, since Jayla has gone off to Starfleet Academy, to see her in that seat where Chekhov would sit. I'm really hoping it would be Eryx from the animated series, but
yes,
I think it would be cool to even to see her on the bridge and even in some other role. We need more prominent female crew members. That's one of the things I was disappointed about Carol Marcus. I didn't think she had a big purpose in the last movie, but it'd have been great to have her in this one, because she did go off on the 5-year mission and nothing was ever addressed about that in this movie as to why she wasn't there.
There was that promise at the end of Into Darkness where, regardless of how you felt how she was used throughout the, you know, the movie, you were left with this sense that she would be back and play a pivotal role in some way, and that's why, you know, she was even introduced. Like, it was her character introduction is what it felt like. And I agree with you, it would have been nice to see her return for continuity's sake. All that said, I loved the character of Jayla. I loved the way that she was played. I thought she was a fun and inventive character, fully believed in her existence. You know, like, I didn't get a sense that this was an actor in makeup. This was a character I was watching in a story, and I fully bought into it, and I fully enjoyed it. And regardless of any other circumstances, I want her back in the next movie in some way. I want to see her character grow now, because I see so many well-developed possibilities for her and directions that she could go in, that they've given us our new character with her. Let's stick with her. Let's follow her. Let's make these movies an opportunity to get to know her even more.
I was talking to Aaron Harvey the other day, and we were talking about Jayla, and in conjunction with Chekhov and Anton Yelchin, and came up with the idea, wouldn't it be great, like you said, Bruce, for her to kind of take that seat, the navigator seat? And it would make so much sense for her to have, you know, she's somebody who grew up stuck in a place, and that a passion of hers would be become flying and being among the stars and that kind of thing. Like, that would be a passion of hers. And again, very much they set up, like Chekhov, she's also kind of a whiz kid with technology. And so she is a good substitute in that way. And like you said, Bruce, it gives you another great female character to have on the bridge. I think it would be fantastic. You know, maybe she could be the new Wesley. You know, she's promoted early.
Hey,
you know, she's
hey,
got a lot of...
Throwing insults around isn't going to help.
She's got a lot
rainbow
of
rainbow shirts.
Yeah. There you go. but yeah, characters all around, they get so much to do in this movie. I think, you know, any of the original series characters that weren't the main three would have killed to have these roles. Because they got so much to do. So that was fantastic and a great, again, celebration of, you know, 50th anniversary. What that brings us to is just kind of the story and the villain here. And I want to ask you guys about that because I think this may be where the film doesn't quite meet the promise that it makes at the beginning.
I wouldn't disagree with that. The reveal is... you know, it's cool in one sense. I thought it was neat, but there were enough questions about the how, in a sense, that like the
why is he Apocalypse apparently?
Yeah, why would he change and stuff like that? In a sense, there was sort of a feeling. Similar to the revelation that insurrection that they were really Baku that had really gone off.
Yeah.
It was sort of like in Insurrection, it was like, and they're really Baku. And I was like, oh, well, yeah, okay, that makes sense. Sure. You know, like that's what made it so, like it was neat because it was, you know, somebody who had, you know, lost their way and everything, but it would have been nicer to have it be if they had shown more video of him, like they discovered it before Uhura did at that point in the story. And, you know, they're sitting there and they're like, oh, well, we found out what happened to the Franklin. Their captain went nuts, all of this stuff. But then she's the one who had been in close contact with him so much that she stops it and looks at it and plays it back a couple of times. So she still gets that moment, but if they had shown it more leading up to and made it, you know, sort of like, you know, that believably obvious thing that everybody misses because they're not looking for it because they're not spending all of that time face to face with him. I guess that's just a long-winded way of saying I think they should have spaced out that revelation more by having more of that video of him sort of progressing through. Sort of the way they handled it, it's a terrible movie that I'm about to cite, but Event Horizon, where the video of the horrific event exists and they're watching it over and over and over again, and then somebody retranslates the line in Latin that somebody says and they go, oh my gosh, no, that's not what they were saying. That's sort of how I would have preferred to see that dealt with here. I hope that makes sense.
I have no idea what you just said. I'm kidding.
That neither do I. That's the problem.
No, I know what you're saying. But, you know, I'll play this a little differently. And I think I would have preferred that this villain was a different alien race, had issues with the Federation, and had different philosophy on how things work. As opposed to being, oh, we got another bad captain. Last movie we had a bad admiral. It seems like everybody outside of the Enterprise, even in the original series, if you're part of Starfleet and you don't serve on the Enterprise, then typically you're going to be a bad person. But the whole thing didn't really work that well for me to see that that Krall was actually a former Starfleet captain. I mean, it was somewhat interesting. It's somewhat of a surprise. I mean, I did kind of know going in a little bit about the story, so it wasn't a huge surprise to me. But when I first did learn about it, I thought, you know, it was an interesting take on it. But I would prefer he just stayed as an alien race that has an issue with the Federation. But I do love the callbacks to Star Trek Enterprise. That was cool to me. I love that they were consistent with that, and he was a former Mako officer. That was really cool. So, you know, the fanboy in me kind of likes it, but outside of that, I think it would have worked better if he just stayed Krall, an alien who had issues.
Well, and this is for me the thing where the movie did fail on its promise, because I would lean over to my wife about 20 minutes before something happened and be like, the bad guy's going to turn out to be from the Franklin. And then, yeah. oh, and they're going to use music to solve the problem. You know, like, the plot points were painfully obvious, and maybe that's because we've watched 700 some odd hours of Star Trek, and so many of the plot points we have seen before.
But did that ruin it for you, knowing that you're figuring it out?
No. Let me put it this way. It just made the movie probably one less star than it could have been, because the plot was too simplistic. Like you said, I feel like it would have been much stronger if Krall had been somebody who had a problem with the Federation. And, you know, I've heard like reviews and things like talking about, oh, this is commenting on the colonialism of the Federation and all that. That's not what this is commenting on at all. If it had been an alien who had a problem and saw the Federation as kind of a colonial power, that would have been different. But having him be a human being who's just frustrated because he doesn't know how to give up war is...
I wouldn't invalidate anything you guys are saying. Like, I totally get that. I would offer two thoughts on it. One, I would sort of spin that even further and have it, if you wanted it to be a comment on colonialism, have it be that the Franklin crash landed somewhere, and then sort of like piece of the action, the, you know, their culture had been, you know, marred, had been damaged in some way because this captain showed up and he was a bad captain and he took, like, he used his technology to take over, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So let me put this question. The second thing is, let me put this question out there. Everybody knows that they had a script. They threw it out, or maybe they shelved it for the next one. But they had a script. They scrapped it. And they came in and they turned around this script and this movie in specific really fast, because they're trying to make the release date. Do you think that this movie is better, gets back that star, Matthew, or anything like that, if they say, you know what? Full stop, we're not going to release in July. Star Trek has always had success historically being released in December. So we're going to give this 6 more months to be released. But do you think that they were scared off? Basically, are the shortcomings of this film and the quick development the fault of Rogue One being in December and Paramount not wanting to go up against it with another Star franchise?
That could be. I mean, I think that the story issues that we have could have been smoothed out if you had had a little bit more time to work on them. Because, you know, one of the most interesting themes of the film is this kind of why we grow as societies and why we grow as people. Because the captain of the Franklin is stuck like Sisko almost at the beginning of Emissary, where he like lives in the past. And he can't move forward. Like, he only sees himself as being a good soldier, but he can't see him being a good diplomat or a good, you know, really a Starfleet captain. He can't find himself in himself the ability to grow past that. Like, he's grown so old that he's outlived his usefulness, as a good friend would say. And so I think that is kind of hurt, though, because his motivations are kind of strange. Like, he now has it out for the Federation, and he wants to make them, like, go back to being at war with everybody. And like, I don't know. I mean, if they have all these ships, he can leave that planet. So it's not like he's stuck there. And it's like, it's all a little, that's where it's just so muddled when you start to actually think about the story and the plot with the villain connected to it. It doesn't really connect all that well. So I think you're right, John. If you had had more time, you would have been able to connect those dots much more fluidly. And we probably wouldn't have had to have this discussion.
Okay, cool.
But, I mean, I have to say, I love the kind of an inspiration of the idea that, you know, look, we don't always have to be fighting with somebody to grow. You know, adversity through fighting is not the only way. We can challenge ourselves to do something hard. Like, when I saw the movie, I was thinking of Kennedy talking about why we go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon because it is difficult. We choose to explore space in Starfleet because it is difficult, not because it's easy, and through that we grow, you know? So Krall can only see that humanity grows, he thinks, through war and strife, but that's not really true. So I liked that juxtaposition, and it's a very Star Trek-y message. And I don't know, it's to me, it was like, wow, what a great message too, because we don't get that a lot in films today. Everybody's so cynical. This movie is so much more joyful in that kind of message that it is trying to get through. I just think, unfortunately, just gets a little bit muddled.
Yeah, you know, though, I mean, as you sit there talking about it, like I almost fall, you know, back toward liking the plot point even more because of the fact that it is the Federation's past coming into conflict with the Federation's present as a way to highlight what the Federation is, that, you know, where it exists, what hopeful place it is in, and how the Yorktown in specific is an affront to the past. All of the, it's this big ball of progress that's, you know, just hanging right there, and the past looks at it and it is, can't comprehend it, can't understand it, doesn't want it, and wants to destroy it. You know, none of that removes, you know, should Krall have been, you know, their own alien? Was there a different way to handle it? But at the same time, you know, I don't know. I almost, like, hearing you talk about it, like, I almost feel like the positives of what they were doing outweigh the negatives of it. And so it sort of evens out in that sense.
Well, as we're talking through this, the issues that I had with Krall is exactly what we're discussing here. But as we're going through it, it's making me think about why would a Starfleet officer like this all of a sudden want to attack the Federation? I understand his logic, but it doesn't really make that much sense to me. But at the same time, he has formed himself, sucked this alien technology or race into himself, that he looks different. He looks like an alien. So maybe this is an aggressive alien that's kind of the fusing of these alien genes are just messing up his mind. And that's one reason why he isn't making total logical sense. At least that's where I'm kind of forming this in my head canon right now.
Well, and in the end, I mean, it's one of those areas in which I think we see in a lot of films where evil finds a way to be its own worst enemy, and that happens to him too. And so I like that, Bruce, that, you know, he has been not only affected by just being on this planet for so, like, they were lost for so long until apparently somehow they got all these ships. Anyway, but yeah, there's something about maybe he has been affected mentally just by draining the lives of others and the inhumanity of being willing to take other lives just so you can continue to exist in the way that he does. Like, he's very Voldemort-ish in that way.
Oh, like, see, I think Dracula.
Yeah, that kind of thing, he's too. Like, he has a lot of classic villains. So, well, I want to ask you guys about some other things before we get to the ratings here. The music and the effects, the action and the design here. I wanted to ask you guys what you thought about those things, because, you know, those are a huge part of Star Trek films, and especially, you know, with the budgets that these Kelvin timeline films have, they can do a lot of cool stuff.
I thought the effects were top notch. I loved the design. I am like a broken record. I don't know who I am anymore because I keep raving about the costumes. But the costuming was just next level fantastic. For
don't you want to get one of those from a Novos? You just really want to order one of those. Those things are sharp.
It's a lot of money, man. It's a lot of money. But yeah, I mean, like, yes, if wishes were fishes, we'd all cast nets. And one of my wishes would be that jacket. But I think that the score, and this will sound odd, but I've always been a fan of Giacchino, but I wasn't like particularly enamored of the 09 and Into Darkness scores. I thought they were good, but they didn't grab me. This one, though, did. And for me, like, I've sort of been playing it in my head. It's because Giacchino he almost feels like he altered his style a little bit for this. It felt a little more appropriate for Trek. Like there were specific music cues that sounded like very subtle call outs to previous scores.
Yes.
And felt like TOS or felt like Star Trek VI, or, and they were hidden in there. And I'm sure that he did them as like little tributes or something, but it just, the sound of the movie is so important that I think that this was the first score of the Kelvin timeline where it was different enough, but it felt like a Star Trek score to me. Like I set, like the previous two were distracting enough that it took me out of it. This one, it just felt like the film's voice and it felt right.
I love the soundtracks to the previous two. I listen to them quite often, so I'm very familiar with them. I think there's a lot of great themes in that in the music. I can associate the music to the movie. I can just see the movie play in my mind when I listen to the music. Of course, I'm not that familiar with the music yet with this film as I am with the previous films. I don't even have the soundtrack yet. Yet I will get it, and then I'll become more familiar with it. But I love the music in this movie. I love the uniforms, as you guys were saying. When I first saw the image of these uniforms, it took me a moment to get used to them. But now I just really, I feel like maybe they're just a little too formal for like away team missions. I guess with the shoulder pads or something like that. It almost looks a little formal and not as relaxed as the previous uniforms, but they do look crisp and they look nice and the coloring is just perfect. And the designs of the Yorktown, I can't even say enough. I would love a whole series, a TV series or a whole series of movies of just of the Yorktown and all the adventures going there, like a Deep Space Nine series, but it's all the Yorktown. I think it's a fabulous opportunity to play around in that environment.
John, you were calling out specifically the music, and so I wanted to mention a couple of things. One is the track Night on the Yorktown reminded me so much of a combination of the Enterprise fly around from the motion picture, as well as Ilea's theme kind of put together, yeah. Where it's this gorgeous symphonic representation of the beauty and the grandeur that you're seeing as they fly around the Yorktown and show you all the ins and outs of it and the beauty of this place and just the kind of the wonder of it. The music was perfect. And then the very next track on the soundtrack is the Dance of the Nebula. And there are some specific call-outs there to some of the orchestrational cues that you'd get in the motion picture with V'ger and some of those kind of like just really kind of strange, but it's very subtle. It's so well done. So yes, I'm right there with you. I was picking up on those cues and what Giacchino was doing here. And I feel like I liked the other two scores. I thought they were fantastic, but I feel like he just upped his game. I feel like he just kind of went back and watched some Star Trek episodes, he watched some of the movies, and got inspired in a way that maybe the other films hadn't just inspired him. Maybe that's just because this film feels so Trek. You know, you just can't help it. And then I'm with you too, Bruce. The Yorktown is incredible. Love it. I'm right there with you. Can we please get a Yorktown, Star Trek Yorktown series? I think it would be fabulous. I mean, you've even got Admiral Paris there, which I loved that little call out. Fantastic. She'd be a great lead for that series. I'd love to see that. And the Franklin. Can we talk about how awesome the Franklin is as a design? I mean, I love that starship. It's fantastic.
The Franklin design was great, and I did not know until well after that it was named such as a tribute to his father, Justin Lin's father, Frank Lin, and that even on the naming plaque on the bridge, there's an allowance to make it look like Frank Lin. There's extra space between the K and the L. And I think that was really cool. I think it's well worth praising, but the design of the Franklin was awesome. And I loved the way they played with it, especially the scene where they took off from the planet, where they were basically slaloming down the side of the mountain to get to the escape velocity, and just like roared up. That was, they played to the advantage of the Franklin's design in those scenes, how it looked and how it would feel in frame. I thought they did a fantastic job.
One of the last things I want to talk to you about real quick is just the action. Justin Lin's known for his action sequences, obviously with the Fast and the Furious. What did you think of the action sequences here? Did you feel like they're on cue? Did you have trouble following them at all? How did that go for you guys?
Yeah, I love the action sequences, but there were times where the camera is moving around so much and is too close to the action that there were times, and maybe because I was sitting real close to a big screen in 3D, but there were times that it took me a moment to figure out what was going on. Some things weren't all that clear. Now, if I play it on my TV at home when it comes out on video, it might be easier for me to see. But there were times where I was looking all over the screen saying, okay, wait, what's going on here? I'm missing something. It's the camera's moving too fast and we're too close to the action and it's all over the place. So I would fault some of that in the viewing experience of not being real clear on some of the action sequences.
For me, for the action sequences, I will say that that Mike Schindler, another host on the network, gave a heads up on Twitter that the 3D conversion was very weak in the non-space scenes. So that might have contributed to things for you, Bruce, because 3D is the tool of the devil and you shouldn't spend money on it. And I think that the camera work was fine in the action sequences, with the one exception that jumps out at me is when Scotty was running around trying to get power back into the engines to get them to go. When the camera was devoted to him in those moments, it didn't work for me visually. It was very hard to follow. Isn't the right phrase, was the only one I can think of. I have a friend, a good friend, who's a lifelong Star Trek fan, who hated the action sequences in this, did not like them one bit, and detracted greatly from the movie for him overall. So I know that Lin's style can take some getting used to. I know that it's not for everyone, but the only action sequence where the camera movement didn't work for me was specifically Scotty when he was trying to get power to the engines.
For me, the only scene where the action was just maybe it was just too much quick cutting was the fight scene between Jayla and the other.
That's what I was thinking too.
There were some scenes where it was just the cut was so quick, it was hard to figure out who was where and what was what. Other than that, I honestly saw it in IMAX 3D, my second time, and I felt like that was the best version of the movie I saw. It looked really good, and maybe it's just that theater is kept up really well, and it's doing a very good job of creating a clear picture and all that kind of stuff. So I really enjoyed it.
Was it IMAX, or was it just LIMAX?
Just LIMAX probably, okay. But the theater, it doesn't feel like it. The projection of the film, I find there, is always good. So okay. I've had good experience in that theater. So, I actually love the way they use the motorcycle. You know, I thought all the complaining that people thought about, oh, it's going to be awful and Beastie Boys. And I mean, but the motorcycle scene, it was so smart and so fun. And what a great way to kind of bring that element in and make it feel completely worthwhile. So to me, Lin found a way to kind of merge a more action-y Star Trek with more Star Trek messaging and make it feel like that it had a home, you know? And I thought that was really nice. So there's absolutely no complaints from me on that. I had a wonderful time with all of it. I really did. Very last question before I ask you for your ratings. The Enterprise A?
Yeah.
Because I gotta say, if I thought the J.J. Abrams Enterprise was bad, they took that design and just made it worse? How do you do that?
I didn't have a problem with the Abrams designed Enterprise. I don't really have a problem with the A, except, like, I mean, I guess there was no way around it, but you know, once they wreck the first one, but like, just it felt almost like they felt obligated to make the joke. Like, it's, you know, I don't know. I think when I saw, I would have preferred a different registry number, honestly. I mean, screw it. We're in a different timeline. You know, make it the 11701 or something like that. Like, just putting the A on it is where I was kind of like, oh, okay, guys, I knew this was coming, but all right. Like, that is the part. Like, I didn't have a problem with anything that they did design-wise.
I didn't have a problem with the design. And, you know, I would like to see eventually in the next film, I'm sure we'll see the ship. I'd like to see different angles of that ship that might help to even further determine whether I really like it or not. I thought the nacelles looked more proportion with this ship than the previous ship. But I don't know. It looked like the previous ship just modified a little. And I guess that's the thing, as I really was hoping for something different. It's the same thing I felt when I saw The Voyage Home. I remember when they premiered the Enterprise, I was disappointed that it looked just like the previous Enterprise. I was hoping for something a little different. And that's how I felt this time. I wanted something really different. And I'm with you. I saw the A. I was like, oh, that's sweet. But I was really hoping that we wouldn't see until the next film what this ship is going to be. And is it a different design? Does it look like the Prime Enterprise? That's really what I was expecting, is a Prime Enterprise.
Yeah.
Well, the Enterprise A is my absolute favorite from Star Trek VI because they finally got a bridge design and everything about that ship looked wonderful from the inside to the outside. It is immaculately designed ship. The lines on it are incredible. Everything flows. It's a beautiful ship. It's funny to me because, you know, one of the hallmarks of Star Trek is the elegant design of things. And we actually see that in the Enterprise before it's destroyed. There's no more industrial areas, if you notice. Everything looks much more like the Star Trek that we're used to, which I loved. But this new Enterprise, again, the A, and I'm sure that it's probably going to be different when they actually render a full scale, like, you know, CG model that's not for the very end of the movie. I'm sure that it's going to be tweaked and whatnot. But this one, again, the saucer just looked out of proportion with the body, which was larger than the one before, and the cells kind of with it looked kind of odd. It just, Starship design with Matt Jeffries and the way he created it, there was a balance to things. And so any of the starships that we've seen that I love are the ones that look most balanced and most elegant. Hence my love of the refit Enterprise. It's just the most beautifully designed Enterprise. Maybe it's also because it's also Art Deco in space.
Yeah,
I don't know if I would call the original Enterprise elegant.
No, not the original. Okay. I'm talking about the refit from the films.
Okay, well, I mean, that's
so that and the A are my favorites.
Okay, I don't know. I think you're being a little hard on it.
Well, I think you would agree this is better than the USS Discovery for the new series.
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
you know what? We're not having this conversation,
We're not
guys.
Having this discussion.
We are not having this conversation.
Before this turns into an all-out fight, what are your ratings for the film? Bruce, where would you go with Star Trek Beyond?
Well, as I mentioned, I really love this film, but I'm hard-pressed to give it 5 out of 5 because the villain idea behind it being the Starfleet officer, I mean, it's okay, but it just doesn't really sell the movie for me. But everything else about it is the characters, the call out to Leonard Nimoy. I mean, we didn't talk about that, but, you know, just that Prime Spock has now passed away, and we see later a photo of the Enterprise crew from the Prime timeline, which came from some little movie called Star Trek V. I think John has seen it before.
Yeah, I was so, that was such a happy moment. It was so great.
It was an incredible moment. It was like a tear-jerking moment when he opens the up the picture and you're like, one. Oh, I was it's like, my thank friend.
You guys. Thank you.
And for those who don't know, John loves Star Trek V.
I
hey,
do.
I love Star Trek V too.
Yes, well, we all love it, yes, but not like John
you have
does.
To.
But outside of that, I mean, everything else was great. So, yeah, I would say I would give it 4.5 noogies of Kienzer acid snot.
Wow, that's that rating scale is unpleasant. I will say this, that I hate, I've actually grown to hate giving ratings for things on any scale. But if I were boxed in, I would say that I would give this right now. It's, you know, quote unquote definitive rating with me is sitting at 3.5, but it's in danger of going up to like 3.75 to 4.
Danger, Will Robinson, danger.
Yeah, I know, right? No, but like that's the thing is like, it's almost in reverse of the previous two Kelvin timeline movies where as I revisited them and I went back to them, my esteem for them fell. As I think more about this, as we've had this conversation, as I've talked about it in other places, my esteem for this movie is going up. And so for right now, I will leave it at 3.5 out of 5 colliding asteroids in a nebula.
I had so much fun in this movie, and it was so surprising to me that the movie was so much fun. It had so much Star Trek in it. And I was just, I really do, I love so much of this movie. I'm forced to say that, like The Force Awakens, this movie is more about character than it is about story. Now, what's great about this movie is that these are characters that I care about even more. So that really helps. When we're talking about Kirk and Spock and McCoy and Scotty and Sulu and Chekhov and Uhura, I love these characters. And the fact that they were able to create so many great moments with all of them makes this 4 out of 5 snow globes in space. I mean, this is a great Star Trek movie. And, you know, for me, I'm having trouble on my Letterboxd list. Does this go where Star Trek 09 is on the list at 4, or does it stay where it is at 6? I'm not quite, I just don't know what to do with it yet. It could flip. Like, I'm with you, John. My esteem keeps going up with the film the more I think about it. And I want to go back to the theater and see it again. So I think that in and of itself speaks high volumes for the movie, you know, because unlike The Force Awakens, where I continually had to massage myself into liking things, I came out of this film a fan, and I just keep wanting to go back and enjoy it more. And the more times I think about, especially the character stuff in the film, I find my esteem going up. So, like you, Bruce, it can't go up further, really, because when I think about the actual movie part of it, the plot line and stuff like that, and the villain, some of the things fall apart, but everything else, the character moments, celebrating the 50th anniversary so well, covers a multitude of sins. So it's fantastic, and so glad y'all were here to talk about this with me here in the Ready Room. And before we go, Bruce, let everybody know where they can find you online.
Well, you can find me on Twitter at @Admiral_Rex. And you can find me on Literary Treks with Matthew and also with Dan Gunther. And I'm occasionally on with you guys on the 602 Club, where our floors are not as clean as it is here in the Ready Room. I'm still really impressed with the clean floors around here. This is just incredible. I feel like I can eat off of these floors. But you can also find me also on the Star Wars Report. If you like Star Wars, check us out there. And you can also find me in the Babel Conference.
Well, you know, the great thing, though, about the 602 Club, though, is that she doesn't serve this crap Simtha Hall. So I gotta love that. Now,
I was just going to say that I like the food on the floors because I never feel the need to order. I can just go down and grab a snack.
It saves you money. You can drink more. Yeah. So, John, thanks so much for being here tonight. Where can everybody find you online?
Come on, everybody. You know where to find me. I'm Kessel Junkie, primarily on Twitter, but everywhere else. You can find me over on Stage 9 with the delightful Mike Schindler talking about Star Trek creators when they're not making Star Trek. And you can also find me on Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast with you, Matthew. And that's over on the Nerd Party Network. And then you can find me with my pal Craig, co-hosting Words with Nerds, a sort of all-purpose nerd podcast.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me in the Ready Room.
Matthew, is it okay for me to come out from the other side of the room now? I've been in that soundproof booth over there. Can I come out?
Yes, all the spoilers are done. Okay. I closed the spoiler box, Chris. We're okay.
Good.
The JJ mystery box has been closed, so we're safe.
Excellent, excellent. Well, thank you for running the feature for me today. I hope it went well.
Yes, Chris, we had a blast talking about Star Trek Beyond.
Beyond!
And that's right. And I've got to say, I'm just so excited that this is the film that did get released for the 50th anniversary. I feel like it is a good way to celebrate Star Trek in 50 years.
Well, Star Trek Beyond is, as I understand it, a wonderful celebration of Star Trek during the 50th anniversary. But also, our discussions here on Trek FM are a celebration of Star Trek as well. Here's a quick look at some of the other things we've been talking about.
Previously on Trek.fm, to the journey! He tweets out, you know, like, hey, walking around with my mobile emitter, you know, hashtag blessed. You know, it's just, I'm sure that's what he's doing.
Oh, gosh. Yep. He's taking photos of his holographic non-dinner.
The 602 Club.
And even the book started this way, and I remember reading the book and being like, what the F is going on? Because it's just such a strange scene, you know, this muggle caretaker in this house making tea, and you're like, what is happening? But really what's being set up is this bookend of Voldemort looming over everything and finally finding a way to return.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
Every chance they have to get him off the bridge of that ship and have him running around on some planet or shooting some guy or jumping on something, they do. And it's like, he's got that chair there. It looks really comfortable. Let's have him sit in it for a while and command a starship.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what else we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find our shows everywhere you get your podcasts. We're a featured content provider with Apple and iTunes. So go to itunes.com/trekfm, and that will take you right over to our artist page. You can find all of our shows right there, as well as the master feed, which contains every episode of everything that we do, as well as some things that are not released in the individual show feeds. You can also find us on TuneIn, Stitcher. We're back on Spreaker at the moment. You can also find us on Windows Phone, BlackBerry SoundCloud. We're on Google Play Music for Android users. Just look us up in your Google Play Music app. You can also find The Ready Room on Spotify. And of course, you can go to our website and you can stream from the show pages or download the MP3 files right over there. So Matthew, I have a feeling that people want to share their thoughts on Star Trek Beyond. So where should they go to do that?
Oh, goodness, Chris. They can do that everywhere. They can do that on Twitter at TrekFM. They can also do that at Facebook on Facebook.com/TrekFM. If they wanted to email us, they could do that. They could go to Trek.FM/contact. They could choose the show, the Ready Room, and that email would come to you and, of course, to me because I was the host. And we don't want to spoil you, so don't spoil Chris with emails yet.
Yes, and also you're an executive producer of the network, so all the email comes to you, Matthew.
Also, you could leave us a voicemail. Just go to speakpipe.com/TrekFM. And, of course, we have our listeners-only discussion group, which is a great place to meet with all of the fans of the network. So just type Babel into the search field on Facebook, or if you're on our website at trek.fm, you can click discussion on the menu bar and it'll bring you right to the group.
Yes, find us over there on Facebook, facebook.com/trekfm or the Babel Conference. Babel Conference is the place for the broader discussion. And we have an official thread, actually, for Star Trek Beyond pinned to the top of the timeline. You'll see the very cool, I love the poster, actually, for Star Trek Beyond. You'll see that artwork right up there at the top of the timeline. Please post your comments about Star Trek Beyond there. All right. I would like to take a moment, Matthew, and thank our associate producers here on The Ready Room. And we have a new associate producer for this show. We have Renee Roberts, who has been with the network since the very beginning, and I really appreciate Renee's undying support. We also have Zachary Fruling, Sam Piasek, Kay Elizabeth Janeway, Tim Robertson, and I would like to welcome aboard David Shuford as a new associate producer of The Ready Room as well. It's thanks to everyone here, Renee, Zachary, Sam, Kay, Tim, and David, that I'm able to produce the show and get it out to you guys. So thank you so much, everyone, for your support of The Ready Room and the network. And thank you also to everyone who supports us in general on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, you can find out how you can help keep Trek FM going. We're a listener-supported network. We do have Eagle Moss as a sponsor at the moment, but that only covers a very small bit of the operational costs of the network. We really do need your help to keep all of the shows on Trek FM coming out to you every day of the week. So head over and find out how you can help us out. Patreon.com/TrekFM is the URL. You'll get information over there. We have different milestone contribution levels, but you can contribute any amount you like, even just $1. We do have special perks at different levels. We have the Patrons Roundtable, where you can get on mic and talk Star Trek with hosts and other listeners. We also have Patron Zone, our special website just for patrons. So find out all about that. Again, patreon.com/trekfm. And we really thank you all so much for your support. So Matthew, if people want to go beyond with you, where can they find you?
Well, Chris, they can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. They can also find me here on the network, as we said earlier, on Literary Treks with Dan and Bruce, talking about the books and the comics of Star Trek, also getting to interview the authors. Great place to be for the 50th anniversary is in the books and comics. They're having a great celebration of the 50th anniversary. And as we know, Chris, you know, those are some of the places that have kept alive the spirit of Star Trek when there hasn't been any Star Trek.
Absolutely.
On the air. So, a wonderful place to visit. Of course, I do The Orb with you, where we talk about Deep Space Nine exclusively. One of the, I think the highlights, honestly, of my podcasting career is doing that show with you and having the respectful discussions that we do about the incredible show Deep Space Nine.
Likewise.
And of course, I do the 602 Club, which is our general geek show here on the network. You know, Star Trek is an amazing thing to love, but we also love so many other fandoms. So check us out on the 602 Club, where we're talking about all those different fandoms, and Ruby serves up the best drinks. And of course, I do a show called Aggressive Negotiations with my good friend John Mills, and you can find that on iTunes under Aggressive Negotiations. And that, we just talk a little Star Wars every week.
Speaking of Literary Treks, Matthew, one of our good friends, and she's been on The Orb with us as well, Una McCormick, wonderful Star Trek author. She just contributed to an article in my magazine last month.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. We had an article about smart cities and future cities. And so I asked Una to write up her vision of what a future city might be like. And I included that as a sidebar in the article. My magazine is actually a business magazine. It's the magazine of the American Chamber of Commerce in Japan. It's a 53-year-old business publication about global business in Japan. And, you know, smart cities, that's a big topic these days around the world and here in Japan as well. And so it was really fun for me to be able to have a Star Trek author, to have Una McCormick contribute to that article. And she was so gracious and did that for us.
Well, I mean, as long as the smart cities, you know, don't start like saying, I can't do that, Matthew.
They're not going to say that. They're going to say, I can't find that. Would you like me to look it up for you on the web?
Would you like to know more? Just like Starship Troopers.
Yeah, right. All right. So, well, if you'd like to find me, you can find me in a variety of places as well. Elsewhere on the network, you can find me, as Matthew said, doing the Orb with him. I do Hyperchannel from time to time, our short news show. I edit Warp 5. I publish from there to here every day. I do a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff these days, not so much on mic because I'm never here in the studio. I am always on the train or at work where I can't do things related to the network. So I do behind-the-scenes things, so you can find me there. You can also find my writing about Star Trek on the official website at StarTrek.com. Just look up my name, C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C. Brian with a Y, and Jones. That's also my username in social media. So on Twitter, on Facebook, pretty much anywhere in social media, you're going to find me there, C. Brian Jones. And I'd love to talk to you there about Star Trek and anything else that you'd like to discuss. Oh, Matthew, we should also mention the Trekka Film store, because I know that our art director, Aaron Harvey, is putting some new designs in the store. I know there's one coming up for Star Trek Las Vegas. And we also have many great designs. You're wearing one right now, if people could see you on camera.
I am.
What are you wearing today, Matthew? It's like you're on the red carpet at an event. Who are you wearing, Matthew?
Oh, well, Chris, I'm wearing an Aaron Harvey original. It is the Word Cloud in the shape of the Refit Enterprise from the Star Trek movies. And I do mean, you know, Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, DeForest Kelly movies, and it's just fantastic. It's in a wonderful heather gray charcoal type color. It's fantastic. It's very comfortable, roomy. You're gonna love it. Get one. It's gonna be the best decision you ever made.
It's fantastic. I love the adventurous cut as well.
Yes. Well, I mean, it does come. I think you can get it in, like, you know, the Risian cut that has the weird holes in different places. I just got the regular American T-shirt cut.
Okay.
So yeah.
All right. The AT. Yeah, I got it.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, if you'd like to get this shirt or any of the other wonderful designs that Aaron has done, you can find those over in our store on Redbubble. It's very easy to get there. Just go to trekafilm.store. Trekafilm.store. That's the URL. It'll take you straight over there. Most of the money goes to production of the item that you purchase. We get a very small amount back, and that money does help us keep the network going. So it's a great way to show your love for Trekka Film, spread the word about Trekka Film when you wear these things, and also help us publish shows and get them to your devices at the same time. Again, you'll find that at trekafilm.store. All right, Matthew, well, I'm going to go back and keep counting the days until Star Trek Beyond opens here in Japan, or at least set up that Amazon alert so I'll know when I can order the Blu-ray from America.
Well, Chris, don't hold your breath. I think it's time to stick a space station snow globe in it, because the Ready Room is done.
Recording. All right. Beyond pants. It's like some kind of fashion that's beyond pants. What would that be?
So, like, the scant?
Oh, the scant. That's what
it is.
Yeah,
I mean, that's beyond pants.
It is beyond pants.
There are absolutely no pants involved.
Exactly.
Let's just hope the men under there are wearing, some athletic underwear or something.
Something, I hope so.
Otherwise, nobody wants to see Riker crossing his legs on the bridge in a scant.
Oh, that would be so funny if they had stuck with that and Riker's uniform throughout The Next Generation had been a scant. He walks up to Data, props his foot up on the console.
Oh, man. Gives the alien on the view screen a nice view.
Right.
It's like that episode of Friends where Phoebe is dating the guy who constantly has his peckers showing, you know, and his athletic shorts.
I kind of remember
that.
Exactly
like that.
Oh, that would be funny.
Oh, except it's Riker.
Oh man.
That's comedic gold right there.
Okay, let me lead us into this. Okay.